Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Shanitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's program. It's a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, and it's a two-part series, Progress in the Treatment of Follicular Lymphoma, and part one, which is today, is Overview of Follicular Lymphoma and Current Treatment Options. And it's this collaboration that has allowed us to reach so many of you on the call today, and we're delighted. We have over 693 people on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. From all different regions, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, China, Fiji, Greece, Italy, Jordan, and Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's really a credit that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care, and those materials is information about the program and our collaborating organizations as resources for you. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. You know, you are the best people to tell us what programs we should be offering, and indeed this particular series is one that many of you have asked us to offer, and it is the sort of beginning of a new year, 2012, and we're planning many new programs, and so we take your recommendations very seriously and would very much like to be sure to implement what you recommend. Now, today's program is supported through an unrestricted grant to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Spectrum Pharmaceuticals, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program today, and particularly also want to thank Brian Tomlinson of the Lymphoma Research Foundation for his being the really architect of today's program as well. Now, we have many speakers today on the program, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Stephanie Gregory, and Dr. Gregory is the Elodia Kemp Chair of Hematology. She's Professor of Medicine, Rush University Medical Center, Rush University. And Dr. Gregory is going to really talk about lymphoma in general and then talk more then specifically about follicular lymphoma. Dr. Gregory?
Thank you, Carolyn, and welcome, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. This is one of my favorite topics, so I'm going to enjoy this next 15, 20 minutes. We talk about the lymphomas as really a very diverse group of what we call lymphoproliferative disorders, or cancers of the immune system, essentially. And the lymphomas are made up of the cells that make up the immune system. These are usually cells called lymphocytes, and they reside or live in little nodules that follow blood vessels called the lymph nodes. And as I said, it is an organ system, but it's really throughout the entire body, just like the cardiovascular system is. When we talk about lymphoma, it is not unusual for the lymphoma to be in various areas of the body. And that doesn't really have the same connotation as somebody who has a lung cancer and it spreads to the lymph nodes or something like that. So I think it's very important to understand that the lymphomas can occur throughout the entire body, and that doesn't necessarily mean that that's a bad prognosis. Now, the lymphomas are divided into two general large areas, Hodgkin lymphoma and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And the non-Hodgkin lymphomas account for most of the lymphomas. They continue to be increasing in number rather than decreasing. And the other type of lymphoma called Hodgkin lymphoma has been very stable in its incidence. It's about 8,000 new cases a year, whereas the non-Hodgkin lymphomas are about 65 to 70,000 new cases a year. And they tend to be increasing in number. And I think it's the reason for that are many. I can't go into all those reasons, but it tends to be a disease of aging, and so I think our immune system gets a lot more hits as we get older. We have more perhaps exposure to toxins, to environmental challenges. I think that we're also transplanting more patients, and so heart transplants, kidney transplants, we have to have immunosuppressive therapy to keep those transplants from being rejected by our body's own immune system. And so if we suppress our own immune system too much, we could develop lymphomas. And for example, one of the earlier recognitions of lymphomas and immune deficiency was in the 80s when we saw lymphomas increasing in the AIDS population. Other reasons may be, as I mentioned, exposure to certain toxins and pesticides. And today there are actually some rare lymphomas that can be caused by bacteria, such as a low-grade lymphoma that can occur in the stomach that's actually related to the bacteria that causes ulcer disease, the H. pylori. Now, the lymphomas are divided into many, many different types. And I don't want you to think if you have one type of lymphoma, there's one treatment that fits all. Some lymphomas are curable. Others are not curable. The most common lymphoma is called diffuse large B cell. It is curable in a large number of patients with a regimen called R-CHOP. But what we're going to talk about today is the follicular lymphoma. And that is the second most common non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But in a way, that's much more like a chronic disease. Patients may live for years with that disease. They may need treatment over and over during the course of their disease. And we really today have no real standard of treatment and no standard of care for the follicular lymphomas because there are many different approaches and not one treatment is really the best treatment at this point. And Dr. Pagel is going to really talk more about the treatments available for the follicular lymphomas. How do we diagnose the follicular lymphoma? I think most of our patients will present with painless swelling of one of the lymph nodes. It may be in their neck. It may be under their arm. It could be in their groin area. Many times, the presentation is in the abdomen, and we may not find that unless a doctor is doing an evaluation or an x-ray for some other symptoms, perhaps. And because the follicular lymphoma is referred to as indolent or slow-growing, many of the times the lymphoma may be in many areas throughout the body. And we refer that as a more advanced stage of the disease, even though that doesn't imply that the patient's going to have a worse prognosis. Now, when we see someone who has an enlarged lymph node, we don't sit on it very long. It is very unusual to have a lymph node that is not without pain. If it's painless, that's rarely an infection. And so I have seen many primary care doctors give some antibiotics for somebody that may have a swelling in their neck. If you have a hard lump or a swollen gland, it needs to be biopsied. It is probably not correct to stick a needle in that lymph node or whatever the swelling is and try to suck out some cells because lymphomas are so varied that we really need a good, what we call an excisional biopsy. You have to take a piece of that lymph node out, give it to the pathologist, and then that pathologist does many, many studies on it instead of just looking at it under the microscope. And what we have learned today is that there are so many lymphomas that may look like each other under the microscope, but when we start looking at the cells that are on the surface of that cancer cell, when we start doing special chromosome studies on that tumor cell, it may be a different lymphoma than what we thought. And so all those special tests that we do after taking a biopsy are referred to not only as the pathological evaluation, but we do something called flow cytometry. We're looking at the surface markers of that tumor cell. We look at the genetics of it. And in the follicular lymphoma especially, we know that there are classic markers on the surface of the cell, and one of them is called the CD20 marker. And many of you may know that the treatment for a CD20 lymphoma, it may include a drug called rituximab. We also know that the follicular lymphomas have CD10 associated with them. And there's also a chromosome abnormality that occurs in about 95% of the follicular lymphoma patients. That's a translocation that leads to an overexpression of a new protein called the BCL2 protein, and that protein probably prevents the cancer cells from dying. And so some of our newer therapies may be directed against that abnormal protein that occurs in the follicular lymphomas. So we talked a little bit about the biopsy. If it is a lymphoma, The doctor then should certainly do blood tests, a complete blood count. We do something called the LDH level, which looks at the cell proliferation. We could do something called a beta 2 microglobulin, which is helpful in prognosis. And we also do CAT scans to help with what we call the staging. And the CAT scans will look at the neck, the chest, the abdomen, and the pelvis. And in some indications, we may do something called a PET scan. Not all lymphomas necessarily need a PET scan. And after we have all this back on our patient with follicular lymphoma, we can actually say what stage it is. And stage 1, 2, 3, and 4 is how we stage the lymphomas. But I told you that many patients with these low-grade lymphomas may present with a stage 3 and 4, and so that alone is not the most important thing prognostically. There is something called the FLIPI, or the Follicular International Prognostic Index, and that looks at the number of lymph node sites on physical examination and on CAT scan. It looks at the blood count of the patient, the hemoglobin. It looks at the age of the patient. It looks at the LDH level, and it looks at the stage. And then when we put all those together, we can actually prognosticate which patients may do a little bit better and which patients may do a little bit worse. But again, that's not the only thing we look at. With the advent of the new drug rituximab, many patients will be receiving that now. And so they actually have modified the FLIPI category, and now there's something called a FLIPI 2, and that really takes into consideration the fact that many patients now have received the drug rituximab. And then we look at those prognostic factors, and patients are actually living longer, even if they have a higher FLIPI staging category. So again, staging is important. The FLIPI evaluation is important. Certain blood tests you know we should do. And then we have to decide whether or not treatment should be done. And right off the bat, I'm going to say treatment for follicular lymphoma varies from patient to patient. The physician and the patient need to make the decision together. It is important to look at the tumor burden. If you're asymptomatic, you don't have a lot of big lymph nodes, you don't have a great big spleen, your blood counts look good, we can do something called watch and wait. And watch and wait essentially means that we watch carefully, we examine you every 3 to 4 months, but we don't have to treat you. It is so important to understand that earlier treatment is not going to make a difference in your outcome. And what we don't want to do in this disease, where really we're trying to turn it into a chronic disease, we don't want to over-treat you. And I think that was an error that we made years ago as physicians when we only had chemotherapy. Every time the disease would come back on either physical examination or CAT scan, we would rush in and give you chemicals again, chemotherapy. And what we learned that if you give too much chemotherapy, it actually damages the normal blood cells in the bone marrow, and it could cause secondary cancers. And so we worry about something called myelodysplasia or actually acute leukemia, and you don't want a patient dying from that because it could happen very quickly if you develop those secondary diseases. So you want to know what your tumor burden is. Is it a low tumor burden? If you need treatment, it's usually because you have high tumor burden or you have symptoms of fevers, chills, weight loss of 10% of your body. Maybe you have low blood counts, which means maybe the lymphoma's crowded out the normal blood cells in your bone marrow. Maybe you have what we call bulky disease, and your physician knows exactly what that means. For the lymphomas, we consider therapy if you have a mass of lymph nodes that measures more than what we call 7 centimeters. That's several inches in size. But just 1 or 2 lymph nodes that are 2 or 3 inches or 3 or 4 centimeters doesn't mean we need treatment. So, you know, you need to talk to your doctor about what your characteristics are. Are you young and healthy and low tumor burden? Are you older with comorbid conditions and bulky disease and you need treatment immediately? There are so many options. The other treatment that's available today that will be discussed is that you can tag something onto this new monoclonal antibody called rituximab, which is called immunotherapy. That is not chemotherapy. You can tag something onto that rituximab, a little bit of radiation, and that's called radioimmunotherapy. That treatment's over in a week, very few side effects. The blood counts will drop. The counts usually recover within a couple months, but we have seen some very, very improved survivals and long durations of remissions. So I think I'm going to let Dr. Pagel talk about additional treatments that can be given. And because the disease will come back, there are therapies that, if they weren't used initially, can be used when the disease does come back. And for the younger patient, you might want to consider bone marrow transplantation. So thank you very much, and I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Pagel.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Gregory, for a very informative and very comprehensive and compassionate presentation. Just really excellent. Thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. John Pagel. Dr. Pagel is Associate Member, Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. He's also Associate Professor, Medical Oncology Division, UW Medicine, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And Dr. Pagel is going to address some current treatments, managing the side effects of treatment, communicating with your healthcare team, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Pagel.
Well, thank you so much. It's absolutely a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure in many ways. It's a pleasure, of course, to follow Dr. Gregory, who is absolutely always wonderful to listen to. Stephanie, you're great, and thank you for the opportunity to follow you. And I would want to say, of course, that I really welcome the opportunity to speak to patients. This is why we like to be doctors, because we want to help people, and this is one of the ways we can do that. And I think it's really exciting to be able to touch people in a large audience like this, and I hope that I can provide some beneficial information in a lot of different manners here. It's a little bit challenging for me. I have a lot of things to touch on, and we'll do it in about 12 to 14, 15 minutes, somewhere in there. I will start a little talking about how we approach treating patients. Now, Dr. Gregory did a wonderful job of addressing that not everybody needs treatment. We commonly might watch people for a long time, but there are other times where people might need treatment sooner rather than later. That might have to do with how fast their disease is growing, how old or young they might be, how aggressive their disease might be behaving biologically, and a variety of other factors. In general, I will say that we need, as was discussed, a need for treatment. So we certainly need to see that people are progressing with enlarging lymph nodes. Perhaps their blood counts might be a little bit low. Maybe they have some other issues that require attention and need for treatment. And that even may be symptoms that were addressed as well previously. So what do we do when people need treatment? Well, there is truly really no one standard of care, as was mentioned. There are lots of different treatment approaches, and that's why actually there's so much hope and promise in managing patients with this disease. Certainly we know that there are lots of treatment choices that are all very effective, and one size doesn't fit all for everybody. There are some treatments that are very appropriate, perhaps for somebody who might be a little bit older, that might not have quite as many side effects or toxicities. And there might be a different kind of approach that you might take for somebody who might be considerably younger, who might want to take a little more upfront risk in dealing with some side effects that might provide some more potential for long-term benefit. One of the things, of course, that we always do in patients when we treat them is usually treat them with some form of the antibody rituximab. Dr. Gregory talked about rituximab. It's an anti-CD20 antibody, and it can be used in a variety of different ways. It's not uncommonly used as a single agent, maybe somewhere between 4 and 8 weeks, delivered once a week, and it has very nice response rates and a very low toxicity profile. It's very well tolerated in some patients, in most patients, I should say. Now, that's not the only way we use rituximab, of course. We commonly combine it with chemotherapy, and there are lots of chemotherapeutic approaches that are available in combination with rituximab. It's very clear, however, though, that combining this immunotherapy approach, antibody approach, rituximab with chemotherapy provides very good benefits that can be long-term, lasting, and very well tolerated. CHOP chemotherapy is something you've probably heard about. Combined with rituximab, it has been around for a long time and for good reason. People do very well with that regimen, have very nice responses, with the vast majority of patients getting complete remissions and people having very durable complete remissions. But sometimes we may alter that regimen. You may hear a regimen called CVP combined with rituximab. It's very similar. Perhaps a regimen containing fludarabine, a variety of other agents, and including bendamustine. This is a drug that lots of people are talking about, people are receiving, and it's a relatively new drug for us. And there is significant interest in this drug because of a randomized trial that was primarily performed in Germany, where patients were randomized to get what's commonly given here in this country, rituximab and CHOP chemotherapy, to this other regimen, bendamustine and rituximab. And the advantage, perhaps, to bendamustine is that it is very well tolerated and people don't lose their hair with that regimen. CHOP, you will lose your hair. It will grow back, but that's certainly something that most people do like to avoid. We don't know exactly what regimen might be preferred. Every regimen might be a little bit more preferred in one patient over another, but the early data suggests that the bendamustine and rituximab provided very good response rates, perhaps slightly better than we might see with R-CHOP, and that the time to needing additional therapy or progression of your disease might be longer with rituximab and bendamustine versus R-CHOP. So certainly that's a reasonable approach that many people are interested in, and it's also possible that bendamustine might have slightly fewer toxicities, perhaps from not only losing your hair, as I've mentioned, but blood counts being more tolerable with bendamustine compared to CHOP. So we treat people appropriately based on, again, all those factors, their age or their biology, how things are changing, and we try and get people in the best quality remission we can. Of course, we approach this like we would approach now any cancer patient. Getting the best remission is important for patients in lots of ways. So hopefully we achieve what we call a complete remission. What do we do when we get a complete remission? Well, commonly we'll give some additional ongoing type of treatment, or what we would call consolidation, as a way to hopefully improve the depth of the response or strengthen the response, so to speak, so that at least the disease will stay away for absolutely as long as possible. Hopefully that's years and years and years in the upfront setting. In fact, most people will say, when they come to see me in my office, they'll say, listen, I don't mind coming and seeing you. I don't mind having blood draws, but I want to go as long as possible before I need my next treatment. So one of the ways we might achieve that goal is by, once patients get into a remission, we may do an ongoing maintenance approach with rituximab, and that's a very popular approach based on a famous trial or series of trials that you've heard about, most likely, and one of them is known as the PRIMA trial. In that trial, patients got a remission from their upfront rituximab and chemotherapy regimen, and then went on to get maintenance rituximab in an ongoing fashion. And maintenance rituximab typically is one dose every couple of months. There are studies that have looked at it every 3 months. There's even been studies looking at several doses every 6 months. The point, however, is to say that you're going on with some maintenance therapy with the idea that you're suppressing the disease significantly to hopefully keep it from coming back for as absolutely long as possible. There is another potentially very good option for many patients that we need to think about in this type of setting, and that's consolidation with radiolabeled antibody. And Dr. Gregory mentioned this. This is a way for the antibody to be a biological vehicle to deliver radiation directly to sites of disease. It's kind of a smart bomb, if you will. So the antibody is the car, and it's injected into the bloodstream intravenously. That bloodstream's the highway, and it's driving along looking for its parking spot. In this case, the parking spot CD20. So it drives past the lungs and the liver, and it finds those CD20 positive sites on the lymphoma cells. And then when it parks there, it will open up the trunk, and the luggage will be taken out. And the luggage is that radiation that's attached to the antibody, and it's directly delivered to the cancer cell. The main agent that we use in this way is known as Zevalin. It's an antibody that's attached to a very safe dose of outpatient radioactivity that can be delivered in the front line in this first remission as consolidation for patients. It's a one-time treatment, so it's not giving it every few months for a couple of years. It's just one time once people have already achieved a remission. And clearly we know that that's a very efficacious or advantageous way to deliver therapy, and that what it does is it improves response rates and certainly can help keep people's disease away for long, long periods of time before it might come back. So that's an option to think about, and sometimes patients need to approach their doctor and talk about that as an option. Certainly, people will get very good remissions in most cases and do very well, but disease commonly will recur. We know that. That'll happen multiple times, and hopefully this is such a chronic disease that those are things that we can live with, we can do fine with, may need treatment every once in a while, off and on for a number of years. But overall, when we get other therapies, we drive the disease back into remission and hopefully have long subsequent remissions after a first relapse. There are lots of factors, of course, to consider once patients have relapsed. That those things are certainly how old people might be at the time of their relapse, how much disease burden they might have, what some of the prognostic factors might be, their comorbidities or other factors that are going on in their health care. And another important factor is what the prior therapies that they might have received would be. Sometimes we'll treat people in the relapse setting with the same type of therapy that they received previously. That's typically reserved for certain classes of drugs and when patients have had long remissions to that same therapy previously. But nonetheless, retreating people with similar regimens is not uncommon and in many cases can be the absolute right thing to do. We do typically use rituximab commonly as well in relapse settings. We, of course, use a variety of other chemotherapies, some of which we've already touched on. And there are many other antibodies that are very important as well that might be considered here in addition to rituximab. And I'll point out that that radiolabeled antibody, Zevalin, is something you can also get as a single agent when people have relapsed. I would encourage to think about that type of approach if it's going to be considered earlier, perhaps, rather than later, because that we know that that's something that might work much better in the earlier relapses than the later relapses. Certainly, one thing to talk about briefly that people always are interested in is stem cell transplantation. This is something, however, that is important to remember is not something that most people will ever receive during their treatment encounters for their disease. It's rare that we do stem cell transplants in patients. Certainly, we do them, but they're typically reserved for people who might be a little bit younger. They may be for somebody whose disease has failed multiple other treatments, or we don't think it's going to respond well to other agents that are still available, and that disease might be growing relatively quickly, and we think that we need to hit it with a big hammer, so to speak, in many cases. That's the idea behind most stem cell transplant approaches. So what we might do is we might take and isolate stem cells from the patient's blood and store them in the freezer, and then give them higher doses of chemotherapy, sometimes associated with radiation therapy as well, with the idea that hopefully we will kill many more, if not all, lymphoma cells, and hopefully keep the disease from coming back. When we do that, of course, we'll eliminate much or all of the patient's normal blood-forming cells in the bone marrow, but that's okay. We'll repopulate that bone marrow by bringing those cells out of the freezer, reinfusing them, and that's the idea behind a transplant. But the point I do want to make sure that I say is that this is an option that we typically reserve for very late in courses of therapy, when people have failed almost everything else, and for the most part, because of the indolent nature of this disease and because people do so well with all of our other treatments, this is not an approach that we typically do in many patients. I do want to say that in the relapse setting, there are now lots of other different drugs that are available. Certainly, we know that there are proteasome inhibitors that are interesting. There are a variety of other antibodies targeting other what we call markers on the surface of the lymphoma cell, including drugs that target not only CD20 or other CD20, anti-CD20 antibodies, but there are drugs that target CD22. There are drugs that are targeting a variety of other markers on the cell surface, and those are all in development and all appear, again, to be very exciting. There's going to be, as I understand, another cancer care conference call in June that will address some of these newer agents, and I think I would encourage you highly to attend to that session or listen in on that session as an opportunity to learn much more about the new exciting drugs for therapy. I do want to switch now to talking about some of these other topics that were on the agenda. One of them, of course, is managing treatment-related side effects. This is a difficult situation to talk about in this kind of setting because every side effect might be a little bit different, and it might present in a very different way in a variety of different patients. Typically, though, the most important thing that you can do here to manage your side effects is to discuss that very openly and early on in the course of your therapy or early on in the course of that side effect with your healthcare team, in particular with your doctor. As an example, one of the things that we might see with these therapies are a complication that we call peripheral neuropathy. That's typically manifested by some numbness or tingling in the hands or feet. And those are issues that are usually manageable and patients can do well as long as we deal with them earlier rather than later. And the only way we can really deal with those kinds of things is if you talk to your doctor about it. Talk to your nurse, talk to your healthcare team, let them know what's going on. That's extremely important because changes can be made in the doses of drugs or the schedule of drug early on that can be very meaningful. We do know that if we perhaps spread out the doses of drugs or lower the doses of drugs, that in many cases we can manage side effects much more efficiently and still have just as good a response in patients. So it's important to communicate many of these issues. Certainly, we can experience some kind of nuisance side effects that I might talk about. Nausea is one that we're always concerned about. And I would say, again, this is another thing to discuss in depth with your team if you're experiencing that. Nausea is usually something that we can deal with. There are great drugs on the market now and lots of them. And sometimes it takes a little trial and error to find exactly the one that works for you. So make sure that, again, you're addressing that and discussing that. We do like to avoid infections because when we give therapies, the main side effect that can be a problem are infections. Typically, if we see fevers, you need to, of course, be on top of that. Tell your doctor about your fever because that's usually a sign that you're going to need some antibiotics. And those infections almost always can be dealt with and very successfully dealt with. The other thing that we might want to do is give you a growth factor shot to help manage your side effects. Keeping your what we call neutrophil count up, that's a certain type of white blood cell that we know is important for preventing infections. And you've probably experienced in many cases or might in the future subcutaneous administration of these types of growth factors. We usually do a pretty good job of getting people through all of the treatments that I've mentioned by managing their side effects, and people will look back on it and it seems more daunting from the time they start, but by the time they finish, they'll say, I don't want to do it again, but it was manageable. And I think that that's a good, important thing to say about communication with healthcare team between you and your team. Really, quality of life remains the main issue with this disease still. I think it's been discussed many times that with standard treatment approaches, we are still looking for ways to actually keep this disease from ever coming back. But nonetheless, people will live for 10, 12, 14, 16 years. I have someone in my clinic who's had this disease over 20 years and never even been treated. So there's a wide spectrum of patients. And the important point is that if you're going to live those types of years, what we want to do is approach it with excellent, outstanding quality of life. So what's the right right regimen for you at the time of treatment? What are the side effects and how do we manage all these things so that you can continue to work? If you're a bike rider, you continue to do that. Or if you like to hike or climb or ski like I do, I know if I had lymphoma, I would want a regimen that would never let me not get out on the slopes. So quality of life is critically important. And usually those are things that we can maintain. I would encourage you that if you're younger, talk a lot more about other issues that might be relevant for you. And those might be issues around fertility and other quality of life concerns around perhaps sexual health. If you're a little bit older, maybe you're going to want to talk to your doctor about some of the things that are more important to you, and that's reducing the amount of side effects, perhaps taking less risk with your therapy, so that quality of life can absolutely be maintained every single day for you on a day-in, day-out basis. I think, Carolyn, maybe I've touched on those things, and I think most importantly, we should hear from the patients, and I would turn it back to them because they may have some specific questions that would address these topics better than I did.
Oh, well, Dr. Tagle, you're extraordinary, a wonderful presenter, and just really covered really so many important issues for all the people on the call today, and particularly in identifying some of the issues that people struggle with in terms of their quality of life issues and discussions with their healthcare team. And you did quite accurately point out that there is a part two to this program, so that there's more to come on June 12th, new treatment approaches, clinical trials, and making treatment decisions. So thank you. Thank you very much. And Before we take questions, I want to introduce Brian Tomlinson. And Brian is a chief program officer of Lymphoma Research Foundation. He also, as I mentioned earlier, is really the architect of this program, has both helped to plan it and also has helped to get it funded. And I'm delighted to work with Brian over these many, many years. I think it's been over 15 years we've been working together on these teleconferences. And I want to turn the program over to Brian for his words of welcome to everybody.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn, and welcome everybody to today's first part call on follicular lymphoma. I'd also like to thank Dr. Stephanie Gregory and Dr. John Pagel. These two individuals spend countless hours of their days and weeks helping the organization to put on programs like today's call, as well as a variety of other things that they do to support us throughout the year and all that they do to help patients. So thank you very much. And lastly, I'd like to acknowledge the supporter of today's call, Spectrum Pharmaceuticals. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization, and we're devoted to funding innovative lymphoma research and providing people with lymphoma and healthcare professionals with up-to-date information about this disease. Our mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those affected by this disease. Each year, LRF invests millions of dollars to combat lymphoma and to assist those whose lives have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying a cure through an aggressively funded research program and to helping members of the lymphoma community by providing comprehensive, disease-specific programs and services. To date, the organization has funded over $53 million in research and over $9 million specific to follicular lymphoma research. More than 40,000 people access our programs and services each year. These programs and services include a lymphoma helpline where our professional public and mental health staff can assist you in your search for information, resources, and other supports. A clinical trials information service to assist you in your search for clinical trials. A national lymphoma support network, which is a one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients and or caregivers with volunteers who have had similar lymphoma-related experiences. A variety of print and web-based publications and newsletters, including comprehensive disease guides, disease-specific fact sheets, several fact sheets related specifically to follicular lymphoma, as well as relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma, and informational e-newsletters. We have a variety of webcasts and podcasts that are available on our website 24 hours a day to talk about specific types of lymphoma and treatment options. We have a follicular lymphoma-specific website that offers disease and treatment-specific information, and you can visit that by visiting www.focusonfl.org. When you visit the site, I encourage you to sign up to receive news and LRF's follicular lymphoma disease-specific e-update newsletters. Lastly, we offer a variety of in-person patient education conferences on the local, regional, and national levels. For more information, please contact us by calling us at 1-800-500-9976 or visiting our website, which is lymphoma.org. Again, thanks very much to Carolyn, Cancer Care, Dr. Gregory, Dr. Pagel, and the supporters of today's call. Carolyn?
Well, thank you very much, Brian, and thank you so much for just your being a wonderful resource for everybody on the call, the Lymphoma Research Foundation. If you aren't using them already, please take advantage of their resources and their help, and also just a pleasure to work with you. So thank you, Brian. And our next speaker is Maria Chai, and Maria is a clinical social worker, an oncology social worker, and she's clinical supervisor at Cancer Care. And Maria is going to address the services offered by Cancer Care. Maria?
Yes, thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. As an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, I would like to talk about the emotional and social impact of lymphoma and how Cancer Care can help you. When you're first diagnosed with lymphoma, it can be an overwhelming experience. You're faced with a series of choices, and you may not know where to turn. Talking to a Cancer Care oncology social worker can help you get the support that you need. Cancer Care is a staff of licensed, master's-level oncology social workers, and all of our services are completely free of charge. We are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. One of the most important things to acknowledge about the emotional impact of lymphoma is that it can be felt as a loss. It can be a loss that manifests itself in many ways for both patients and caregivers. That's why it's so important to have an outlet to acknowledge how you're feeling and have someone you can talk to who will be supportive and understanding. This can mean talking one-on-one with a Cancer Care social worker or joining one of our support groups. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, as well as telephone and online groups. These groups offer an opportunity to talk with other people impacted by lymphoma, along with the help of a cancer care social worker to facilitate the group. Participating in a support group can be helpful simply by allowing you to talk with others who are in a similar situation and who truly understand in a way that no one else can. Group members offer encouragement and a real sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. Additionally, we're currently in the process of recruiting members for a new online support group for people living with lymphoma. If you are interested in participating in this group, please call our hope line at 1-800-813-4673. Finally, lymphoma can have a significant impact on your finances, and for many of the people I talk to every day, this can be an overwhelming aspect of lymphoma. Cancer Care provides limited financial assistance to help with transportation to treatment or with home care, child care, or pain medication. We can also connect you with other organizations for additional assistance to help you with the costs of lymphoma. While we may not be able to resolve all the problems you're facing every day, a cancer care social worker provides a listening ear and the ability to counsel you as you navigate the lymphoma experience. Many people living with lymphoma find this to be a reassuring and comforting service that can help you feel that you're not alone. So please contact us at 1-800-813-4673 or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Maria, and that's a wonderful review of the services here and great compassion. Thank you so much. And now we have time for questions. I want to thank all of our speakers that we have this time for questions. I'm going to ask Trinitha to explain to the audience how to queue up for questions. And if you don't get to ask your question, we invite you to call the Lymphoma Research Foundation or Cancer Care at the end of the call, and I'll give you those numbers again as the call, when the call's ready to end. But right now, let's see how many of your questions we can take. Trinitha?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch tone telephone. If your question has been answered, or if you wish to move yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question is from Jerry Kay. Your question, please.
Yes, there have been discussions that that instead of watch and wait, because of all the new therapies, that it might make sense to start therapy as opposed to watch and wait. Any opinion?
Excellent. That's an excellent question.
I'd be happy to start on that, and then maybe Dr. Pega will have a follow-up on that. You know, years ago, and this is before immunotherapy with rituximab was approved, there were studies looking at early treatment with chemotherapy, and at that time it was mainly an oral pill, an alkylating agent called chlorambucil, and it was compared to a group of patients where there was only watch and wait, and they were patients, again, who were asymptomatic, low tumor burden, follicular lymphoma, and the results of that study showed that there was no difference in overall survival, whether you were treated early or whether you received a watch-and-wait approach. That was reported back in around 2003, and that was way before everyone was using rituximab as part of any treatment. More recently, in the past couple of years, the same author actually looked at using early immunotherapy with rituximab, compared that to a group of individuals where they did no therapy, watch and wait, and then a third group where they received 4 weeks of the rituximab therapy and then 2 years of rituximab maintenance, like Dr. Pagel talked about. And what was interesting in that study is it did show that obviously the patients who got some kind of a therapy, which was again not chemotherapy but immunotherapy with rituximab and had 2 years of maintenance, they actually, their disease stayed in remission compared to the group that was watch and wait. We would expect that because they're getting some kind of a treatment for their disease, whereas the watch and wait group was just sort of progressing along at its normal pace. The physician who did that study tried to make a very strong argument saying, see, we should use earlier therapy, because what his final results were is, yes, it kept the disease in remission longer, and it prevented the patients from having to receive chemotherapy sooner. You know, many of us in the lymphoma world say, but but they really are receiving some kind of therapy. You know, what are the long-term consequences of someone receiving 2 years of rituximab treatment? Will, when they really need that drug, will it not work? When you do have to combine that drug with chemotherapy because maybe they have lots of symptoms, will it not work as well? I don't think the answer is out. And, you know, fortunately, patients with follicular lymphomas live a long time, so they really couldn't say that there was any improvement in overall survival by using rituximab therapy early compared to watch and wait. So, you know, again, there are a whole group of us who consider ourselves lymphoma experts who still do not jump on the bandwagon, do not rush in with earlier treatment, and do believe still in the watch and wait approach. I'd be happy to hear what Dr. Pagel has to say on that point.
Dr. Pagel, thank you.
Yeah, Stephanie, you know, I agree completely with what you've said. I think the thing to keep in mind here is that it's very hard to be overly aggressive in many patients up front when people are newly diagnosed and they're asymptomatic. If you're asymptomatic and don't have other problems, it's hard to imagine giving somebody some difficult therapy that might make them sick when they're already feeling well. So the watch and wait approach, in addition to the reasons that Dr. Gregory mentioned, are still important to me in my clinic. I will say, however, though, that we've never really proven formally in this era, in the biologic era of rituximab, if treating people up front right at the time they're diagnosed, and again, this is in select patients, perhaps somebody who might be a little bit younger and willing to take more upfront risk, if that's the right thing to do or not. Until we get a randomized trial where we take patients who are asymptomatic today at time of diagnosis and randomize them to get treatment that's probably relatively aggressive or no treatment, we're never going to really, really adequately be able to answer that. It has been looked at a little bit in the trial of using rituximab at the time of diagnosis, but that's very controversial of using single-agent rituximab versus observation in these patients, and what many people will say is that that's a reasonable approach, but it's not going to extend overall survival. So until you need some treatment, watch and wait probably still is the right thing to do in the vast, vast majority of patients.
And I will comment that, Stanford, has done transplants at diagnosis. That's really an aggressive approach. And we have a very small pilot study that I did years ago. It only had 20 patients in it, and you don't talk about little numbers that you have, where we did a very aggressive approach to patients who were really asymptomatic with follicular lymphoma, including 4 months of chemotherapy, which was very much aggressive at that time. Again, Rituxan wasn't part of it. And then we did an autologous stem cell transplant. Out of that 20 patients, I have 2 patients who are alive and well 15 years down the road. Now, does that mean we cured them and they haven't had another treatment? Or does it mean that, yes, they had aggressive treatment, we put them in remission and their disease could still come back? These are anecdotes. You can't go on 2 patients that are doing well because they had transplant up front. So, when you hear people say, oh, but I read that if you do this early on, you can cure the disease or something. You know, there's no data out there saying that.
Well, Greg, that was a great question and a great first question to get us started. It was really terrific. We hope you'll take this information back to your treating healthcare team and it'll help you in making your more informed decisions about your care. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Julie C. Your question, please.
Yeah, hi. It actually relates to the watch and wait. That's what I'm doing right now, and quite frankly, how do you address it when it's just waiting for that shoe to drop? And when you address the quality of care, of quality of life, the overwhelming fear is that shoe's going to drop any moment.
That's an excellent question.
John, you want to take that?
Yeah, let me take that. Julie, this is a conversation that clinicians have in their clinic with patients all of the time. I would say that I always like to tell my patients, let me do the worrying and I'll do all of that, and when there's time for you to worry, I'll let you know. Now, that's easier said than done, and that's, in fact, why lots of patients or doctors will not call it watch and wait. We'll call it watch and worry because, of course, that's what happens. You're waiting for that shoe to drop. But what I want to say mostly about that is that when the shoe drops, it's usually not a big deal clinically. Typically, what's going to happen is your doctor is going to feel a lymph node on an exam, or perhaps they might see an enlarging lymph node on a scan, but you still are going to feel perfectly fine. Or maybe there might be some other small issue or something. But again, typically patients will be asymptomatic still, and the doctor's goal will be to perhaps intervene just before there are problems for you. So when the shoe drops, as you like to have described it, which is a good way to describe it, it's not really coming down hard with a big boot, so to speak. It's usually something that we say, okay, listen, within the next few months, we're going to probably want to need to think about treatment. And that's, again, telling you a lot about how this disease behaves. It behaves in a very indolent, usually well-manageable fashion in the vast, vast majority of patients. So it comes over time. Over time, you kind of learn to live with it. You kind of learn to handle it. Not saying that it's easy, not saying that you want to deal with it that way, but you can understand that you can go on, have a normal quality of life, do very well, and likely do very well for many, many years.
Excellent point. And
what was interesting from the study that was done where the patients did receive rituximab versus the watch and wait group, they did have a quality of life evaluation in that group, and there was no difference in the quality of life whether you had early treatment or you were watch and wait. So, you know, we are beginning to do some of these quality of life trials studies with anything that we do to patients now.
And
I think that's a great point.
Do you want to comment, Maria, on just the issue of the kind of how many of our people that we work with deal with or get services to help them when they are worrying? Because that is kind of many people do worry in treatment or when they watch and wait. Could you comment on some of those things?
Sure. Of course, it's a sort of amplifies a diagnosis like this amplifies the uncertainty that we can certainly face every day for a lot of different reasons. And that is, you know, whether it's one-on-one support or support in a group or talking with a peer with a similar cancer can certainly be something that helps you manage that anxiety on a day-to-day basis.
And Dr. Pagel, did you want to add?
No, I think that's fine. I think we've covered that.
You know, I do think we should mention that the Institute of Medicine came out with a report a couple of years ago saying that really the need for evaluation looking at the psychosocial aspects of every patient with cancer is dramatically underutilized. And I think we as healthcare providers have to be aware. And I try to always, you know, without saying to my patient, are you okay mentally? I say, this is a stressful situation. Nobody wants to hear they have cancer. Please let me have you at least see one of our social workers and our psychologist if you'd like to, just to address some of your concerns. And if you don't have those concerns, maybe the concerns of your spouse or your children or whoever. So we have an integrated cancer medicine program in our facility, and I do tend to utilize them much more than I ever did in the past.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think this today has been a good example. There's lots of resources to handle these kinds of issues about worrying or not understanding things, and that's where the LRF website, as an example, comes into big play. If you don't have those resources at your own center, go to that type of resource on the Internet, find out the information you need, or go find out where you can ask somebody for that information.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Jonathan M. Your question, please.
Actually, my question has been addressed. It was regarding the efficacy of using Rituxan as a maintenance supplement, as it were. And I can tell you that my decision in being concerned that doing so would reduce its the ability to use it down the road and my desire to do less is more in terms of treatment, I decided in March 2007 not to do it, and hey, I'm still here.
So let me tell you about the results of a trial that just came out. The Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, which is a large multi-institutional cancer group, did a study called the RESORT trial, which was Rituxan Extended Scheduling or retreatment. That's where they sort of got the name RESORT trial. And they took patients with low tumor burden. It was mostly follicular lymphoma patients, but it included other patients with low-grade lymphoma. They received 4 weeks of rituximab, asymptomatic, so low tumor burden, didn't need treatment. 4 weeks of rituximab. 2 months later, they had CAT scans to evaluate their response. If they had a complete response or a partial response, which meant 50% tumor reduction, they were randomized to either no therapy until the CAT scans showed progressive disease or the physical exam showed progressive disease, and then that arm received 4 more weeks of rituxan. And that occurred every time that their disease came back. The other arm, every 3 months, received one infusion of rituximab. And that didn't stop at 2 years. That went on as long as the patient's CAT scans, which were done every 6 months, showed that they were still in a complete or a partial remission. As long as they weren't growing through those rituxan treatments, they were kept on rituxan. At the American Society of Hematology this December, the results came out. And it was reported from the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group that there was no difference in either arm. Patients did just as well if they received retreatment with 4 weeks of rituxan when their disease came back compared to the group that was receiving rituxan therapy every 3 months until it no longer worked. I have to tell you, I had 4 patients on that trial at my institution. For unknown reasons, all 4 of them got randomized to the rituxan every 3 months, and they were on it for 5 years each, continued rituxan therapy. One patient elected to go off of it because he started having some side effects from the rituxan, increased some upper respiratory infections, some sinus infections. He elected to go off. But when the results came out, we were obliged to tell the patients the results of the trial, give them a letter talking about the results because of it was a clinical trial, and the patient could make up their mind whether or not they wanted to stay on the rituxan maintenance or come off of the rituxan maintenance and just be retreated when their disease came back. All 4 of my patients elected to go off of the rituxan maintenance, and I did not influence them. I gave them the data. So it's interesting. I think your point is well taken. Many patients are concerned about what are the long-term implications of being on a drug that it looks from many trials that we're not seeing long-term side effects except these maybe a little increase in these upper respiratory infections. But it is not a therapy without risk.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. Excellent. Our next question, please.
Our next question is from Pavani R. Your question, please.
Hi. Thank you so much. This was a great discussion, and I am here because my mother was 2 weeks ago diagnosed with lymphoma. She's 55, and I have a couple of questions, or maybe same question, different parts to it. My first question is, so she has also been advised 2 years of this rituxan maintenance. So my question is, would they develop some kind of immunity to this, and so that, like, in the future, if she does get it back and if she's treated with, you know, R again, would it not work because her body has developed some kind of immunity?
That's an interesting question. I'll jump in. What you're asking, I think, is will she become resistant to the therapy? Immunity is one way that could happen. We don't believe that actually happens, and it's really actually unclear if people actually become resistant to the drug, so to speak. There's a lot of research being done that's been done and continues to be done trying to address that, and it's relatively unclear. What we do know is that people will become resistant to all types of treatment over time. We clearly know that. So that happens just from changes of biology, and that's why responses might be a little bit less after multiple relapses than they would be earlier on in treatment encounters. So resistance happens, but more to your question, if you get repeated ongoing long-term use of rituximab, are you more likely to develop that? And there's absolutely no data that I'm aware of, and Stephanie could correct me, but there's no data that suggests that that's the case. So I wouldn't be overly concerned in that way from that standpoint.
Agree.
Okay, well, thank you. I want to thank our speakers. You know, this has been a remarkable call, I must say. It's just wonderful speakers, wonderful questions that you've all asked, really. I just want to thank you all for participating, to all of you who have been listening as well. I do want to remind you that there is a part two on June 12th, and we hope many of you have signed up for that. But if you haven't, please do, because it's on new treatment approaches and clinical trials and making decisions. And also, if you didn't get to ask your question, please contact either the Lymphoma Research Foundation at 1-800-500-9976. Again, the Lymphoma Research Foundation, 1-800-500-9976, or contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. Most importantly, as we conclude the call, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with follicular lymphoma or in coping with your lymphoma in general or cancer. We want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and please do call us. We're only a telephone call away. Thank you all, and have a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.